Welcome to session 7E, titled Liquidity Risks, Improving Matches and Yields. My name's Martin Pano and I will be chairing today's session. We have two presenters today, Anthony Asher and Simon Webb, who are well qualified to talk about this topical issue. Anthony has held a number of senior positions, both in South Africa and in Australia, including being the chief actuary at Prudential Life in South Africa, and is currently a consultant at Deloitte Consulting. Simon is Anthony's colleague. He's been working in the financial services industry for 7 years and is a specialist in the banking, mortgages and wealth management areas. Before handing over to Anthony, just a couple of housekeeping issues. The presentation's going to go for about 30 minutes and then we'll open up for questions. Just remember the session's being videotaped, and when you ask a question, use the microphone and state your name. So over to you, Anthony.
This is my second presentation today. The first was in unit pricing risks, and my little spiel has been, while I know a little bit about unit pricing risks, I know nothing about this liquidity risk, but I am comforted by the fact that I don't think anyone does. I've read what is available, and I've done it, obviously, spent a fair amount of time thinking about it, but I'd really be interested to hear what your comments are. I've taken a few punts that may be a bit controversial. We have. Simon, of course, does know a fair amount about what he's doing, but that's how I could persuade him to come and talk. First two issues, that's our agenda. The first two issues I'll talk about, just a bit of definition and theoretical causes and discussion of government. Then Simon and I will play alternating roles for the last three. Definition, the risks that assets can't be turned into cash or equivalents. A market failure caused by insufficient buyers or sometimes sellers at a fair price. And that, I think, is actually quite an interesting definition of liquidity crisis, but does highlight the fact that it's a market failure. And if it's market failure, the theoretical causes, monopoly power, externalities, or asymmetric information. Now, in the context of the current crisis, or the crisis that we're just past, I hope, or almost past, insufficient buyers for securitized loans because the potential buyers did not have the information to determine a fair price. So this is an asymmetric risk problem. There are a whole lot of products out there which people hadn't adequately modeled. The people that had done the modeling subsequently were proved to be wrong in their assumptions. And once the assumptions were wrong, the level of confidence in understanding the business evaporated and no one was prepared to buy or sell the assets concerned. I had talk at one stage, no, I heard an email from a hedge fund participant of 2090 bonds. Bid 20, say, offer 90. In other words, that was the margin between those who wanted to buy and those who wanted to sell. And that was the degree of ignorance in the market. So when they say talk about liquidity drying up, it's not that you can't sell or buy, but not at a fair price. So the role of government. Now, government intervention is intended to of the monopoly externalities and asymmetries, government intervention may be necessary in each case. Very often attempting to ameliorate externalities can lead to market failure. So I think it's generally agreed, for instance, that the global food shortage we're currently facing comes from government intervention in corn prices in the States, with the consequence that it's now they're all being used for ethanol and we've got no food around. So, and this is rereading some of Adam Smith the other day. That's Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations passionate idea. Don't let the government get involved because they're bound to cause more trouble than they're worth. but we can't. That's what part of the idea. On the other hand, there are some interventions that government has to do, but obviously incredibly carefully. Governments do preserve the integrity of the payment system. If we didn't have the integrity of the payment system maintained, we get what we had in the Depression. Banks are just, when the banks go under, all the payments that they support in those local areas just get restricted, and you end up with a depression instead of just a bankrupt bank. But it leads on to moral hazards. banks take on unsustainable risks because they expect the government to bail them out. Now, just 2 points on that. The first is just the list of the liquidity crises we've had within my working life. Savings and loans in the 80s, emerging markets in the 90s, junk bonds in the 90s as well, and then subprime now. These things come again and again. The banks are somehow go too far and end up taking on risks that lead to fairly significant losses. I think, and this is one of the controversial ideas which you might like to consider, it's not essential to the paper, but it is of interesting. I don't believe there's an adequate charge for liquidity in the market. I think banks have got used to the feeling that they can provide liquidity and government will bail them out. So money supply is not a big issue these days, but if we look at the Reserve Bank's calculation of money supply, M1 is 20% of GDP. In other words, there's enough money in current accounts in Australia to cover, 10 weeks of transacting without any income being earned, if you like. So we've got $200 odd billion of money sitting in transaction accounts. And I think the reason is because the banks pay interest on those accounts, and therefore there's no incentive to people to reduce their liquidity. I mean, if you're lucky enough to be in my position, where I have an offset account, I could actually write a check out for a year's salary and it's not costing me, that level of liquidity is not costing me a thing. Some of you will be in a similar sort of position. It's absurd. There must be a cost to liquidity, and we'll come on to that later. That's one of the part of management. M3, which includes all bank accounts, is over the size of all bank liabilities, deposits in the banking system, is greater than the GDP. You've got enough money to buy to buy everything that's produced next year already in the bank. Doesn't seem right. Cash should be there for short-term transaction costs, and this is just too big. So why is it so big? I suspect because of this moral hazard that we've got ourselves into. So the challenge, and it's the big challenge, is to reduce the need for implicit government guarantees, perhaps a role for professional liquidity risk actuaries within banks, and that's something for the profession to think in terms of the wider fields, and just the view that better insurance replaces the need for liquidity. And so we actually have an interest, as representatives of the insurance market, to try and increase the cost of liquidity because it increases the demand for insurance. Because one of the reasons why you need liquidity, the reason you need liquidity is, in fact, in case something goes wrong. And if you've got, if you're covered insurance-wise, you don't need liquidity. So I'll hand over then to Simon to describe briefly the 2007.
Thanks, Anthony. My name's Simon Webb. I won't dwell on the 2007 credit crunch all that much. I mean, a lot's been written about that. But I'll pull out some interesting statistics or stats that I found that were interesting anyway that I'd like to share with you. I mean, there's little doubt that the catalyst behind the current liquidity crisis and in global debt markets was defaults in the US subprime risk market. And I think I thought this summarised it quite well, to be honest. Effectively, high-risk borrowers able to access cheap money via subprime and adjustable rate mortgages, largely in the US, using residential property as collateral. During a booming US residential market, collateral was easily sold with the profits made, being able to cover the pay off the loan. However, once obviously the property bubble burst, selling and or refinancing became more difficult and losses began to mount. The subsequent result being the impact on or in confidence and that flowing through to liquidity. Some of the statistics I was talking about, home ownership in the US increased significantly in the last 10 to 20 years. from 64% in 94 up to a high of 69.2% thereabouts by 2004, and this was largely driven by a contributing factor to that was ownership in the subprime area, which can be seen on the left chart there, getting up into the 20% range. This caused a huge spike in house prices, a bubble of sorts. Another interesting statistic, I think, between 1997 and 2006, house prices in the US increased by 124%. However, as the price of houses started declining, truth rang true as to our first cartoon, to say those who don't have money potentially aren't going to be able to pay it off. And defaults started to increase, which you can see on the right hand slide there, or on the right hand chart. And I mean, it's interesting, I think, to look at those defaults by vintage year. Quite a powerful chart, I think that one is. As a lack of confidence started to flow through the market, you get an increase in spreads. And interestingly enough, the increase in spreads in 2007, the yellow and the triple B, it's quite it's not that long ago since spreads were even higher than that. But the impact that that's had on the market is quite phenomenal. So I think that just goes to reinforce the confidence factor that we had in 2007, and the impact that that really did have on the market is quite interesting. And also, once again, talking about spreads, but also talking about issuance, and the chart on the right shows the decrease in the massive decrease in just in Australian CDO issuance in 2007 relative to 2006. It's quite a severe decrease. Ultimately, as we're all aware, this all flowed through to losses being realised by somebody. And the chart on the left, we're showing a comparison of financial crises, and in terms of the size of losses, the recent turmoil was obviously large in terms of dollar amounts, but I think interesting to compare that against as a percentage of GDP, which on the left-hand chart the boxes, and you're looking here, for the recent one, you're looking at around a little over 5% of GDP. Compare that obviously to the Asian crisis or the Japanese banking crisis. As a percentage-wise, it's quite small. And flowing through to expected bank losses, I think the key from that chart is to say, the majority of it has been in CDOs, and unsurprisingly, I think there's been a larger share of it in the US market relative to Europe's up there as well. I think Anthony's comment earlier was the message from that is beware of the US. I shall pass on to back to Anthony now, and I shall see you a bit later.
So what happened? What went wrong? Well, firstly, innovation went wrong, but you might expect that when there's innovation, that we're never faced with something new. It takes us time to understand it. I think that's actually quite a profound insight, which I think comes from is reinforced with institutional economics. If you read the economics theory, one of the things that is not taught is institutional economics. The general market theory says the markets are always efficient. Institutional economics says, hang on, it costs to produce information, and information takes time to process. So securitization did provide suitable investments for institutions with matching long-term assets. Securitization is a good thing. We're not saying that it's a problem. And the development of a liquid market for previously unmarketable long-term assets is a good thing. The problem arose is that we got opaqueness. These CDO, collateral debt obligations, can be incredibly complicated. Millions of pieces of paper that you have to read to understand what the risks are. and they relied on assumptions that they were then modelled and priced by people that were making assumptions that were not right. Now, I just go back a little to this particular slide, if I may. This is default. It's probably the default of a month since the since the loan was issued. And you can see the 2000 year, which is the almost complete one, ended up at a 20% default on subprime. So that was the expected amount, and we knew that by 2005. 2004 and 2005, 2003 and 2004 initiations were lower. Then 2005 was higher, started off much the same. 2006 and 2007 started off virtually vertical. By the early part of 2006, if you'd had adequate by the early part of 2007, if you'd had adequate information, you would have known that defaults were going to be some twice as high on the last 12 months' loans as they had been. Well, sorry, you wouldn't have known, but you would could have been suspected that they were going to be twice as high. And anyone with any understanding of volatility, of high rates, would know that if you're going to end up with 20% defaults, that does not mean every year. It means somewhere between 5 and 45 or more. You know, high default rates are not going to be stable. We know that from anyone who looks at econometric trends will know that's the case. So there was a misunderstanding. They basically used far too narrow volatilities in their models. Okay, so there was this complexity. The models made assumptions. Blame the rating agents. The models, same models were used by the rating agencies, by the merchant banks. And the merchant banks put their money where their mouth was. They believed their models and invested, and as a consequence, lost a lot of money. But there are moral hazards in this whole thing, anti-selection in actuarial terms. The mortgage brokers, originators, rating agencies, not exposed to default. The merchant banks didn't think they were exposed to default because they passed business across to their to institutional investors. As it happened, they kept a whole lot of AAA stuff, what they thought was AAA, on their balance sheets, and that turned out to be considerably less than prime. Excellent paper that I refer to by... Rogoff and Ken Rogoff is one of the authors, on going back 500 years on banking crises. This is just a couple of hundred years, regular banking crises, these blue vertical, the number of countries with banking crises, they come all the time. The point they make, however, is that increased foreign exchange flows precede big banking crises. So the red lines are increased capital, foreign international capital flows. When you have that, you end up with banking crises in a lot of countries. If one was to take that seriously, one would say that Australia, with its very significant gross and net foreign liabilities, is heading for a foreign exchange crisis. So if I pretend to be wise for a while, it may not be the next crisis. It may not turn out to be a crisis. But given that our foreign liabilities have risen, the total amount has risen from $300 billion to close on $600 billion in the last 5 years, it cannot continue to go up. At some stage, it turns around, and that turnaround is going to be painful. So there's the, if we stand back, there's the warning. And why liquidity becomes important in such circumstances. Two slides on this avoiding liquidity crisis. Very interesting papers by the FSA and by the senior regulators, which are referenced in our paper. The senior regulators say you must actively, those banks that actively managed liquidity did much better in the latest crisis than those that didn't. Active management of liquidity firstly means to understand really good models, sort of very current models to know what's going on in the credit, and they charged internally for liquidity. So even if the market is not charging for liquidity, it's important to charge internally for liquidity. And some of the slides in our paper show that, in fact, for 2004 and 2005, the market, on some measures, the market charge for liquidity was actually negative. So if you can't market to market, you've got to do some internal charging. Second point there, create sources of liquidity. And that means two things that they say, which I found very interesting. Standby arrangements with other banks. This is for banks. Standby arrangements with other banks, whereby you agree that they will provide you liquidity under certain circumstances. They're not binding agreements. They're merely enabling agreements. Okay, so basically you say, well, if I have a liquidity crunch, I want to have lots of sources of cash around. It may be that many of my sources, no one's prepared to commit to support me in a liquidity crisis, but I need to have the systems in place to raise the money quickly. And that many of these banks found it difficult to raise money quickly because they hadn't had regular fire drills. It's like an evacuation procedure. You've got to practice it. Get your money out the door quickly. You've got to know exactly what you're going to tell the market. You've got to have responsibilities. Got to be properly delegated. Now that's important for the banks. Where I think it perhaps offers an opportunity for long-term institutions like super funds and life companies is actually to sign up for these with agreements to provide liquidity if you can afford to at the time. So it's not a binding obligation, just a facilitating obligation. And there should be a couple of extra basis points to be made in doing that. The second point is that standby arrangements in the marketable assets, that you should have securitized assets that can be traded. And so when the Reserve Bank and the banks are now talking about practicing selling securities, well, Westpac, I think, recently securitized some assets that it didn't want to actually sell, just had them securitized, and it's going to give a bit to the Reserve Bank and then bring it back again just to check that the process works. These fire drill processes are important. For us, and we're running a bit on, I am running short on time, so I'm not going to talk much about it. The next slide talks about matching investors and borrowers. Avoid making liquidity promises that you can't keep, and that's certainly valid for, important for those super funds and life companies that are investing in illiquid assets and alternative assets that are not going to be tradable. As long as you don't make liquidity promises, you can have other sort of promises. Promise to pay your pension. You can promise to pay withdrawing members in specie, in shares, if you like. But don't pretend that you can pay cash when you can't. And then following on from the idea that we should actually charge, that banks should charge internally for liquidity, I suspect that illiquid liabilities can be valued at higher rates, which comes onto one of the controversies in the life insurance at the moment. I was going to spend much more time, initially when we first prepared to do this paper, I was going to spend much more time on this, which is an idea that I've worked on for a long time. It's by far my best idea. It has, however, never been implemented. It basically is like a reverse DB, where the borrower commits to a predetermined proportion of his salary in return for a lump sum. And the investor gets basically a portfolio of salaries that it invests in. Now those are matching assets, and it does do what should be done, matching long-term investors with long-term borrowers. I haven't had a chance to talk to Shauna about her paper on the other subprime crisis, where I think the New South Wales government had something similar to this. Double index mortgages don't work because if you increase the instalment in line with general salaries, people who get less than the general salary increase end up not being able to pay. And I think that's what happened in New South Wales, as has happened in many other places around the world. So you've got to actually pre-decide that you're going to forgive people. You're going to link their salaries, link the repayments to their personal salary, so that there's a cross-subsidy between those who get high increases to those who get low increases. But anyway, I've got 1,000 pages on this, literally 1,000 pages on a fully specified computer system that was never implemented for other reasons. So that's a really good idea. I'd love to talk about it, and I will make another paper at some point on it. But we'll talk about Simon's models at this point.
Thanks, Anthony. Building better models. It's a comment this morning in one of the sessions this morning was that for the subprime crisis and for the recent crisis, ratings agencies understood the instruments. Problem was that investors didn't. And the investors ultimately relied on the rating agencies. Now, whether or not they got it right or wrong is beyond the scope of this discussion. But I think the concept is that the investors didn't understand. Now, the idea of building a model ultimately enables the investor to gain an in-depth understanding of a structure or instrument that they're looking at investing in, and they can ultimately develop a best estimate case and some sensitivity around that. Now, don't get me wrong, I understand that ultimately the modelling is more than likely going to be wrong, but it's all about facilitating an in-depth understanding of the investment that we're looking at investing in. Now, we once again use a securitisation as an example and our mortgage-backed securities. There's fundamentally two concepts in terms of modelling these vehicles. One is to model the underlying assets, i.e. the home loans, tracing those cash flows which are going to ultimately end up in the structured finance vehicle or the securitisation vehicle. Now, in terms of modelling the underlying assets themselves, we're either after... there's two choices. We can rely on portfolio level, i.e. high-level assumptions, or information about the underlying data, or individual loan-level data. And as actuaries, I think we've, for years and years and years, we've been modelling policies, superannuation plan members on a policy level, and the software out there is available and readily used, and should be readily used, and can facilitate this sort of modelling quite easily. Sticking with the underlying assets again, so there's assumptions on prepayments, arrears and defaults. So I think we should all be pretty familiar with what those are and could spend some time discussing those. I mean, there's historical data out there that we can use to help us develop those assumptions, look at our own experience from a client's perspective, for example. And ultimately, we come out with projections on a monthly or annual basis of the cash flows that we expect to emerge from our portfolio of loans, and also, as I said, once again, do some sensitivity around those, changing our arrears rates, changing our loss given default, changing our default assumptions, changing our prepayment rates. These are all going to have significant impacts on the cash flows that are going to emerge from our underlying portfolio. Once we've got an understanding and an expectation of the cash flows that are going to emerge from the portfolio, we need to look at the structured finance vehicle. So we need to incorporate the specific structures of these vehicles. Now, we're talking about some of these can get quite complex, and I do talk about some of the generic structures that exist shortly. As I mentioned before, we're ultimately receiving cash flows from the underlying vehicle, so it's important to get an understanding of what cash flows we're entitled to. Is it principal and interest? Are there any fees that the securitisation vehicle has access to? And once again, we're also allowing for the seniority of payments, taking into account taxes, any expenses, and how the interest and principal are distributed to the underlying note holders. I've briefly discussed a lot of these, so as I said, the key considerations before. So the portfolio or loan level data. At a portfolio level, we can, positives, it requires less input data. Our models are significantly smaller, but the downside is obviously there's less granularity. We're making assumptions at a total portfolio level. The loan level captures individual loan characteristics, so the individual interest rate for each loan, the loan balance for each loan. Can even take into account the credit characteristics if we wanted to put some different assumptions around a better loan than a worse loan in terms of their ability to repay the loan. The downsides are the data requirements can be significant and potentially onerous, and you do need a robust model. As I said before, the actuarial profession is full of robust models that do month by month cash flow projections. I won't dwell on the various assumptions. I've mentioned those, the prepayment rates, arrears rates and default rates and loss given default. As I said, they are important. And then the key is to identify and model the key cash flows. As I mentioned, there's the principal and interest payments, but also the fee income. What fees do we expect to be originated from the portfolio of loans, and what fees are then passed on through the securitisation vehicle? Moving on to modelling the securitisation structure, this is just to give a high-level I'm not sure how familiar we all are with how these structures can be, or how they actually work. So it's just a high level, very simple diagram to explain that the customer ultimately purchases a home loan, for example, in this case, from Company A. Obviously, Company A is the loan originator. So the dialogue between those two. Company A, they might... just had a blank there, but that doesn't look 100% correct. Company A will receive cash from the special purpose vehicle, and Company A will sell a portfolio of loans to the special purpose vehicle. Special purpose vehicle then receives cash from the underlying investors, and the investors receive notes which are backed by the collateral, or which ultimately the pool of mortgages. Looking at the cash flows and how they might flow through the vehicle, we've got cash receipts coming from the underlying assets, as I've discussed, principal and interest and any fee income, and splitting those into principal and interest and fees. The principal can pass through to the investors to repay the note holders and their principal holdings. The interest and fees flow through to firstly pay off any expenses, taxes, expenses of the trust itself. Then flow through to any remaining is passed on to as interest to the bondholders. And finally, there might be residual monies left in the trust, which will become available once the trust is wound up, and could be depending on the structure and the ownership of the vehicle, could be ultimately flow back to the Company A, in this case the originator. There's a lot of different structures and enhancements that can be applied, and every vehicle seems to be different. Common structures, we're looking at a sequential pay where you've got your underlying note holders. Your AAA, for example, might receive the first instalments of cash flows. Once they've been paid off, your AA will start receiving their money, et cetera, et cetera. The money is paid in a sequential order. An accrual tranche is where we've got interest on a particular note won't be paid out, and that money will be used to pay principal of a more senior note. And once the more senior note has been paid, the accrual tranche will then start receiving its money and its accrued interest. An interest-only tranche is where the residual income... A note holder might purchase the residual income, which I talked about earlier, which is the difference ultimately between the revenues or the interest received by the vehicle and its weighted average underlying cost of funds. That residual equity or profitability from the portfolio might be purchased from a note holder. And we've seen that in quite a few Australian securitisations that have obviously happened quite a while ago now. There's also a stripped mortgage-backed security where you're looking at someone's buying access to the interest component and someone's buying access to the principal repayments. So, I mean, there is a lot of diversity, and I think this just goes to show that ultimately building models and enables you to gain an understanding of those underlying structures. And as I said, you won't get it right, but it does facilitate an understanding, which I think is key. Another interesting component of these is the credit enhancements, which can be built into or external to the structure. Looking at those built into the structure, so senior subordinated, where you've got your AAA note holder, AA, and you're working your way down. The AAA obviously is supported by the lower rated notes. Reserve funds and over-collateralisation. I won't go into specific details, but there are a range of enhancements that can be built into a structure and also external to the structure. For example, a third-party guarantee, and I'm sure we're all aware of the monoline insurers and the issues that have been surrounded those recently. I think in concluding... Well, Anthony and I are of the belief that actuaries are well placed to contribute in this area. Modelling the underlying credit risk, modelling's our strength, and in this area I think there's an opportunity that we really should be offering our services to help people in these areas. Designing matching instruments and as Anthony talked about, determining the charge for liquidity and also modelling customer behaviour. That concludes, I think. Any questions, please?
Hi, I'm Brad Milson. I'm in capital management at the Commonwealth Bank. So I thought I might just respond and give the banker's view of the world. I am an actuary as well. So, couple of issues there. First of all, in describing the subprime crisis and liquidity crisis, I think you missed the point a little bit. From my perspective, the issue overall is the level of gearing inside the credit system globally, and particularly in the US. Excuse the long-winded comment here, but of the subprime mortgages written in the US, something like 75% of them were financed from special investment vehicles and conduits or something similar. The basic model of those vehicles was they invested long and borrowed short, largely in the CP markets. So they're investing into subprime mortgages that are returning swap plus 40 or 50 basis points sort of margin, and they are borrowing in the CP markets where they could borrow at swap flat. That was their basic investment model. They weren't actually taking a whole heap of credit risk. Generally, what was going on in those conduits was that they'd have a total return swap back to an investment bank, and the investment banks had managed them with CDOs and those sorts of vehicles. At the 1,000-mile view, that is the general model of what was going on in the US credit markets. Now, what happened was that the rating agencies suddenly revised their view of the losses in the subprime market. It triggered some rating reviews of some of the notes that they're investing in, and a lot of those conduits suddenly hit problems with their investment mandates. That triggered a whole heap of selling. Now, most of the conduits had an underlying clause that if they weren't able to borrow, they could push all of the assets back onto the investment bank that was sponsoring them. So to take an example, HSBC copped something like $45 billion out of one of their conduits in September last year. And there's another three or four conduits that HSBC had exposure to that were borderline on putting the assets back to HSBC. So there's a whole heap of banks that are looking at their balance sheet saying, we've potentially got a large amount of funding to go on here. And the response from the banks was to suddenly stop lending and to suddenly cut their finance as well. So at a global view, you had a sudden contraction in lending that was just unprecedented. And it was that contraction in lending that caused most of the problems. Now, I'm not saying there's not losses in subprime. I'm not saying they're not significant. But relative to the expected losses out of subprime, I don't believe the underlying losses will be that different. Now, I've seen comments that the expected losses coming out of the rating agencies went from 30% of the portfolio to 35% of the portfolio. If you're investing in that and you understand what you're doing, that's not really a large jump, particularly given the nature of the underlying assets. So the issue was more that then you had conduits that were dumping assets left, right and centre, and trading was going on in a market that wasn't rational. And it's that non-rational behaviour triggered large mark-to-market losses, triggered more closures, and you had this domino effect going on. Now, to give an indication of how that hit the Australian banks, Australian securitisation paper at the time was actually having default rates that were reducing. So Australian mortgage performance last year was actually improving. Yet our paper was among the hardest hit globally. Now, that reflects the fact that our paper could actually be traded. And there's a number of instances where the better names were blowing out larger spreads than the bad names, because the better names were able to be traded, but the bad names just weren't trading at all. So it's just symptomatic of a market that is not rational and it's gapping. Talked about the 2090 problems. It's not rational behaviour, so pretending that better modelling is going to solve the problem is missing the point. So that's the Australian perspective on how that whole crisis came together. I don't think the underlying losses were really that big an issue in terms of how it all came together. And just the comment about FX movements and symptomatic of being a sign of potential banking problems. I think the offset there in the Australian case is the degree of offshore investment that comes out of Australia that we have relative to most other economies. We have a much higher proportion of offshore equity ownership and certainly a broad-based holdings. So I think Australians, by and large, don't go and invest in Australian banks. They go and buy equities and a significant portion of Australian equities. So I think the Australian banks borrowing offshore is reflecting investment preferences rather than a fundamental imbalance in where the capital is flowing.
Yeah, thanks for your comments, Brad. I don't think that we're suggesting that modelling has all the answers, and I don't think we're suggesting that this is the be-all and end-all and we can do that, but I think we can provide this sort of modelling. I think does provide some insights. Take your point completely about the mismatch and the like, and there's examples of that here in Australia as well. As I said, it's I think the actuarial profession is well placed to provide some insights into the understanding, at least, or helping people understand what they're actually investing in.
Yeah, and if I look at the industry as a whole, the issue was about understanding the liabilities, not understanding the assets. Mm-hmm. And I would have said that the underlying models for securitisation were amongst the most sophisticated that I've ever seen. Certainly in the US, the guys that are actually trading these CDOs in the market will have credit levels mapped down to the individual street across the US. Yep. And modelling credits by individual cities across the whole of the US. And there are incredibly sophisticated models floating around for all of that, but they were blind to some of the fundamentals of just assuming that they could always borrow no matter what.
Mike Barker, can I just endorse that last comment about having detailed models already? Anthony mentioned that the defaults on the 2006 cohort of subprime were bad right from the beginning, and yet it didn't take it. The crisis didn't hit until June, July 2007. If I can give you a small anecdote, I spoke with a leading investment bank in December 2006, and by then the credit problems were already obvious. They had a very sophisticated model, which was like going down to each district of the United States. And their opinion was that there was a crisis of subprime, but it was restricted mainly to California and Florida. And America had never had a nationwide house price recession before. So what they were doing was buying CDO equities, that's the riskiest tranche, in various areas of the United States which they thought were not going to suffer from a subprime crisis. And then they were packaging them into another vehicle and borrowing 50% of that against that from Merrill Lynch and flogging it off to high net worth individuals and offering returns of 30%+. Now, I don't know whether they actually got it away. I said no, thanks very much, because I thought the housing crisis in the United States was worse than they did. The purpose of the anecdote is to say that the models can be great, but it's your assumptions that are important. And when you're trying to model the assumptions, when you're trying to put in assumptions for a tranche that's only just started, you really need to be aware of how wrong you can be. In this case, they were doing this modelling. To say they were aware of a lot of the problems. They were prepared to take the risk, and that it would have been a very bad risk to take. I think that when the crisis hit, that was when the rating agencies started to mark down the paper, and they seemed to do it across the board. What I couldn't understand is why S&P suddenly decided they were going to downgrade 400 CDOs all at the same time. Why didn't they pick on California and Florida 6 months earlier and downgrade them and leave the good ones alone? I think if they'd done that, the crisis might have developed more. Well, it might not have been a crisis. It might have developed more slowly and not got into the state it did. I don't know what other people might think about it.
Thanks very much. I mean, quite clearly at the heart of this, there is a question as to what happened to house prices and the process of, in effect, borrowing money in the fixed interest market and investing in houses has made money for a long time, and when house prices go down, it stops making money. So the underlying turnaround of the fact that unsustainable price movements have a tendency to be unsustainable is an obvious point, but many of us have seen careers lost on people who established their point, and there's a profound issue for us overall in the industry that it's safer to be with the herd than it is to be warning of problems ahead. I personally don't believe it's anything to do with the models. I believe it's fundamentally to do with the markets. I think we've got a pretty difficult exercise to persuade, to explain how it is that in a world absolutely awash with money, and this is the main thing that's wrecked the life insurance business in much of the world, is the fact that interest rates have been coming down, because after the Asian financial crisis in the 90s, there's been a build-up of liquidity. We've got an oil price rise, and we've got massive amounts of money flowing around, so we shouldn't expect there to be any sympathy for any explanation that says that there's a problem related to liquidity. It is the problem related to translating the liquidity and meeting up with the assets. Now, I don't know how this works here, but I'm profoundly suspicious of markets, of the professional investment markets. And my suspicion arose, I have to say, from observations in Australia, which, just to take a very small example, we had a problem back in the 90s related to the apparent liquidity of some securities associated with power stations. Now, the underlying proposition from the professional investment managers was suddenly there was illiquidity. And this was profoundly inconvenient if you were attempting to run trusts based on this, and one was seeing the managers selling down all the assets except for these assets, which were supposedly illiquid. And they were holding the prices up. Now, the proposition that this stuff couldn't be sold could be easily tested by simply taking a trek down Parramatta Road and offering it to the guys there who are experts in liquidity. But this was not acceptable. And it was not possible. Now, my proposition is, unless you put it on eBay, then you haven't tried to sell it. Now, I didn't see any way, when I was told that that was a problem in the UK related to mortgages, I didn't see any route for me. I was quite happy to actually invest in mortgage securities in the UK. I mean, I'm not very generous. I was envisaging something like 50%. But I mean, don't tell me that it's a liquidity problem. It's a pricing problem. And the answer is in making markets work better. And I recommend eBay as a system. I know maybe the professionals don't use it. But when we can actually make sure that securities can be described and put on eBay and we can all bid for them, then we will have solved the liquidity issue.
Andrew, I mean, that's what we're saying in some respects, that it's the asymmetric information that means that the markets are not working, and that passing on, but there are two ways of, I think it's got to be approached from two ways. The one was that these products were so complex that people didn't understand them. Just to respond to Brad, I mean, the IMF and and general agreement, it is generally agreed that the models of the rating agencies and the banks didn't work because they didn't take up the correlation issue that, that Mike's referred to, that, that in fact for the first time since the war, since statistics were collected, all housing markets in the States collapsed simultaneously. It's perhaps not surprising. No, they did. No, Florida and California initially collapsed, but the rest then followed them. And it's not altogether surprising, because it's actually for the first time since the war that you actually have nationwide home lenders. Previously, the Glass-Steagall Act prevented the banks from acting in concert, as it were. They now acted in concert. Sorry, but to come back to your point, Andrew, the markets need to be informed to function properly. They need many participants that are all informed, and that's really our thesis, is that, I mean, you need places, and maybe eBay is a better place than the Australian Stock Exchange. You can go and debate that with them. But in order to make the market work, you need to have, if we can have some element of standardization. If we can't have the element of standardization, we need experts to translate the complexity into something that's actually simple. And that's where I think we can play a role. We really can show people what the what is happening to these instruments and make it easier to reduce those spreads and therefore make them function.
I agree with about 90% of what you've said there. First of all, I think the comment from Andrew about the world being awash in money, it probably illustrates the point I was trying to make, that I don't think it is today. I think it definitely was 6 to 8 months ago, but today I think you'll find that money is much harder to come by, and spreads, and we talk about liquidity premiums, reflect the difficulty of coming by money at the present time, not necessarily anyone's fundamental issues around credit and around the likelihood of them getting their money back. To give you a quick example, CBA senior debt. Of the issue of the people that we had issued bonds to 12 months ago, 70% of those people no longer exist as an entity, and they're largely in the categories of conduits and special investment vehicles and those sorts of things. And of the remaining 30%, only about 12% are actively in the market at the present time. So you're in a situation where it doesn't really matter what price we're asking, what price we're willing to pay for the debt that we go out to. The total market has shrunk dramatically, and supply-demand dynamics mean that the price for money has gone up full stop. And I haven't seen anyone suggest that the way spreads have blown out is any reflection whatsoever of a increased likelihood of default that remotely reflects the way spreads have reflected. Now, one of the stats that keeps bouncing around is 1.15 trillion losses globally coming out of the subprime crisis. The stats I've seen are, yes, there's 1.15 trillion of mark-to-market losses being reported, but the actual losses coming out of mortgages in the US are going to be something like 300 million, of which 250 million was expected losses on the basic pricing. And a $50 billion loss in the context of the total US economy is a blink. It's not a credit issue. It's a liquidity issue.
That's true. And those statistics are similar to those used in the IMF Global Stability Report. They do point out, however, that the CDOs themselves, $400 billion outstanding, 60% face value losses on them. So it's been, for those who are holding CDOs, it's been a credit crunch.
Well, a CDO is a geared credit exposure and a geared mark-to-market credit exposure. So, yeah, that's got to be expected. And
But I think your point is absolutely. I think we have a table that basically says it's really quite small in the global scheme of things. But can I just pick? I mean, Andrew's right. The world is awash with liquidity. I mean, every $30 increase in petrol prices puts $1 trillion into the hands of the producers. So we've got $3 trillion extra going into the hands of the oil producers. That's got to find a place. Why it can't come into Australia is, why are we paying 8% on deposits for foreigners?
Well,
if that's not a risk premium.
Yeah, but just as a rule of thumb, from what we've seen, our pool of investors has shrunk by at least 70% and up to 90% at the present time. So if that's That's not going to be true globally, but if that's true for the money supply that's available for Australia and international markets, that's what's caused Australian home loan rates to jump by 40 basis points above the cash rate.
I think that, for me, is the core puzzle. Brett's world may well be short of liquidity. Don't quibble with that at all. But the fundamentals, Anthony, that you talk about, the fundamentals of the oil price, there's not any more money being spent, that surplus, the fundamentals related to an ageing population, which we know has issues, the profound economic issue as to how are we going to channel the increased savings, and the Asian consumer and the Asian governments who have built up positive balances. None of that has actually changed. So the problem is in the operation of markets. To translate these fundamentals into the issues of Brad's wholesale market. And that's profoundly about trust and behaviour. And it would be, I do suggest that the vehicles that open up avenues for the public to be more involved and the extent to which that can be done could well be very positive. And we have some expertise in doing that, and maybe that's part of what our product should in fact be doing. Our product should be collecting the savings of this population and routing it into these wholesale markets.
I think we might have time for one more question. Is there someone else that would like to make a comment?
Should be limited on the amount that they can push their credit, their ability to lend money and have a go at the assets before everybody else. Because it seems to me sometimes companies who should have borrowed money more long term, they end up in the banks, and then suddenly the bank says, we want $5 million, so you've got to go and sell your building.
The only counter example that I'd put is I think most Australians would suggest that the non-bank lenders were generally a good thing, and the competition that they put into the banking sector for home loan rates had benefited almost everyone. But their model was fundamentally the same as what's going on with the CIVs, that they were lending long, investing long, and borrowing money relatively short, and that's directly what's led to all of the current problems in the Australian mortgage market. So I think there's political necessities that go the other way as well. I don't think there's any easy solutions.
Andrew, did you have a question?
Yes, very good question. Perhaps a comment as well. It seems to me that although your session is about liquidity, you talk a lot about credit, which is, to my mind, a completely separate concept. And in your last example, you described how you would model the credit, or sorry, the liquidity aspect of securitized mortgage. But if you look at the example of direct property, you can change the liquidity of the underlying assets completely simply by listing it. How would you account for things like that? How would you account for the change in liquidity resulting from different means of transaction? If you understand my question. What I'm making is a list of property. The liquidity of the asset of the underlying assets is not as important as a way that the security is transacted.
Simon?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I don't have an answer for you right now, to be honest, but can think about it and get back to you.
As a similar example, the liquidity of a CDO tranche can be quite different from that on the underlying assets on which it's based. So what changes in the proposition?
I mean, from... I'm not sure if this answers your question or not, but my comments, I suppose, are from what we're talking about here. It's really looking at modelling the actual, you know, the cash flows and how they flow through the vehicle itself. So that, I think that's what I've been focusing on in from this component. I don't think that answers your question, but as I said, I don't have an answer for you right now. But
I think the impact of liquidity basic change is the price. And so that's actually one of the advantages of having a model, is at least you can put in alternative assumptions and create a, somehow create some sort of link. But I think...
Yeah, I think just quickly, your comment about needing to charge for liquidity is correct. And the way I've always viewed it as needing to charge for liquidity is the cost of capital to cover the reinvestment mismatch. So if in the situation... Well, we're used to seeing mismatch reserves in insurance, and it's a similar concept, just going the other way. Liquidity is the capital you need to hold to make sure that you can cover it if you can't reissue a loan.
Unfortunately, I think we've run out of time for some more questions, so I'm sure you'll agree with me that Anthony and Simon's presentation has been quite informative and our discussion quite informative. So would you please join in me thanking Simon and Anthony.